get your map out, look for Hooper Bay on the Bering Sea. That community is included in our district with Fairbanks.
A lawsuit over the state's redistricting plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, century-old boats that still work in Alaska waters.
She's not a museum piece or any kind of a hobby enterprise. She's a vessel that competes every day against modern boats.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough is planning to sue over Alaska's new redistricting plan. And the Aleutians East Borough has passed a resolution opposing the plan and is considering joining the lawsuit. KDLG's Dacia Eaton has the story.
The Aleutians East Borough filed a resolution opposing the state redistricting plan last week. City Administrator Sharon Boyette says splitting up the borough between two districts doesn't make sense to residents.
The communities within our borough are similar. We have similar concerns. We want to speak with one voice. And so we feel like all of the communities should have one person in the House and a senator that they speak to directly.
The change would divide the borough into two different House and Senate districts. The only way to influence the plan at this stage is to file a legal challenge. That's exactly what the Fairbanks North Star Borough intends to do. As Assemblyman Tim Beck explains, the redistricting plan calls for the addition of 20-something rural communities to the west side of Fairbanks, including Hooper Bay in the Bering Sea.
Picture this. Get your map out. Look for Hooper Bay on the Bering Sea. That community is included in our district with Fairbanks. That's a big, big district for anybody to attempt to even represent, notwithstanding the difference of issues that they have in that community versus what we have in an urban area.
Every 10 years, states are required to go through the redistricting process following the federal census. The goal is to adjust district lines to reflect changes in population and preserve individual voting rights. The state formula says the ideal number of voters per district is 17,755. Trying to hit this magic number is what had the state redistricting board tearing old districts apart and putting together new ones. Nine states with a history of discrimination are closely watched during the process and must have their plans approved by the Department of Justice to ensure they comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act.
And it's all centered around the one person, one vote principle, the idea that one representative should represent the same amount of people as every other legislator in the state, or at least relatively close. You know, before a number of Supreme Court cases, that you had this disparity and this imbalance in the level of representation. And you had a lot of cases where minority communities in states were being intentionally discriminated against.
That's Taylor Bickford, the executive director of the Alaska Redistricting Board. Bickford says challenges are expected.
There's never been a plan in state's history that hasn't received some kind of legal challenge. If the plan gets challenged, it doesn't mean there's something fundamentally wrong with it or that the plan is invalid. It just means that there are people or boroughs or municipalities out there that have a different view of how things should have been drawn, and they bring those claims to the court, and the court weighs all the multiple statutory, constitutional guidelines and makes a decision.
There's one thing driving the need to redistrict: rural to urban migration. Eddie Hunsinger is a demographer with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. He says Alaska is going through a big demographic shift, where people from rural areas, mainly Alaska Natives, move to bigger cities like Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, as well as the Matsu Valley, and away from rural places like the Aleutians.
All over the world, there's rural to urban migration.
So what's pulling rural people to cities?
Jobs, or education, amenities, things that folks can enjoy and in larger communities that they don't get in their smaller communities.
Aleutians East and Fairbanks North Star boroughs both argue that the redistricting board is actually weakening the collective bargaining power of Alaska Native communities by dividing up their dwindling districts and pairing them with more populous ones. But Bickford with the redistricting board says the board is just trying to fulfill its obligation to comply with federal guidelines.
There are situations where the state constitutional principles have to be sacrificed in order to meet federal guidelines. If Aleutians East or Fairbanks or anybody else decides to go forward on a lawsuit, that's really what those issues would center around is the Federal Voting Rights Act.
The deadline to file legal challenges to the plan is July 13th. Fairbanks North Star Borough says they'll file their legal challenge to the redistricting plan early next week. If there is a challenge, it will first be filed with the Alaska Superior Court. If there are multiple challenges, they'll be consolidated into one case. Then appeals could be made, and the Supreme Court would ultimately rule on the plan. Whether or not the Aleutians East Borough or others will follow the lead of the Fairbanks North Star Borough is yet to be seen. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
State legislators are pouring through copies of an in-state gas line report released yesterday, but it will be some time before the project gains or loses approval. The report, authored by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, indicates that building a pipeline to carry North Slope natural gas to the state's South Central region can be done at a cost of $7.5 billion. The line would follow a Parks Highway route south from Fairbanks, according to Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation President Dan Foskey, who delivered the report to legislators in Anchorage. Foskey said the project is commercially feasible, would lower consumer costs substantially in Fairbanks, and would pose an alternative to importing liquid natural gas to South Central to offset natural gas shortages here. Governor Parnell told the group via teleconference that the report is a positive step forward and that it merits review. House Speaker Mike Chenault chaired the meeting.
And now it's going to be up to us to go through it, determine are those costs real or not, and if they are, how do we move forward with this project if this is the one that we choose to go forward on. The project is compliant with the current laws that we have regarding AGIA, and at a future point in time, if something changes with the law that's the law of the land today, then other things may change as far as size or even route. But Dan's simply correct that any changes you make now are going to have an effect on the price of a project.
Bill Stoltz, co-chair of the House Finance Committee, said Foskey's address is encouraging. Stoltz said that Matanuska Valley constituents are face-to-face with looming energy shortages.
None of us have read the report yet. It's just put on the table. Looking at the options, and Senator Huggins brought up a point that concerns me is we represent folks in the Matsu Valley that are at the tail end of our natural gas supply, and a lot of pressure on use and supply. We feel it first being at the end of the system. If you're waiting and holding your breath for the AGIA process and the economics of that, you might turn blue and then turn a different gangrene color before you see that.
Foskey said the in-state gas line project would not compete with the much larger AGIA project, which would bring gas to the lower 48. But Anchorage Representative Les Guerra has concerns about moving ahead with the in-state project.
This is sort of a project that gives us a plan C. If nothing else works out, this is what we have to do. But there are reports that there's much more gas in Cook Inlet. That buys us time. But we have to see if the explorers really make that pan out. If the price of natural gas goes up in the lower 48, all of a sudden the big pipeline works. And the advantage of that is the big pipeline produces the cheapest gas for us, and it produces $1 to $2 billion a year in state revenue. That's a better deal than more expensive gas through an in-state pipeline that produces no state revenue because we don't tax in-state gas.
Foskey said the in-state natural gas line would carry 500 million cubic feet of gas a day. He envisions project completion by 2018 with first gas by 2019. Foskey recommends the state appropriate $210 million next session to complete the next phase of the project's design. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska Native conference on the environment.
There's a newfound love and encouragement for how we pass on culture and tradition as it relates to the environment.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
A small fleet of Seattle-based wooden halibut schooners still work Alaska waters, though they're nearly a century old. The Tordenskjold is 100 years old this year. She's expected to work well into her second century. The Tordenskjold and other working ships in the fleet are the subject of a television documentary premiering at 8 o'clock tonight on the Alaska Channel 360 North. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander has the story.
Seattle area filmmaker John Sabella has produced about 20 documentaries over the years, many of them on the fishing industry. He's fascinated by the old schooners.
I can't imagine how many industrial assets that are 100 years old are still making a living, making a profit, supporting family wage jobs, doing almost exactly what they did at the turn of the 20th century or just shortly after that.
The Tordenskjold is the oldest ship in the working fleet, hence the name of Sabella's documentary.
She's not a museum piece or any kind of a hobby enterprise. She's a vessel that competes every day against modern boats. It's quite a remarkable story.
Last board!
A sister ship, the Polaris, is a mere 98 years old. She pulled into Homer last week to offload about 50,000 pounds of fresh halibut. Skipper Wade Bassey is a third-generation halibut fisherman. He's been on the Polaris for 34 years, the skipper for 25, and an owner for 20. His grandfather built the schooner Alton in 1912, when these vessels operated under sail.
He spent $15,000 to build that boat. And to replace this boat, you couldn't do it.
The 87-foot Polaris has been repowered a couple of times. When Bassey had to replace fuel tanks last year, it forced other changes.
We put new tanks in, we put new engine in, we built a new pilot house on it, so you know it should be good for another 30, 35 years.
These things owe their longevity to generations of Norwegian nautical tradition. They owe themselves to some remarkable craftsmen who were building boats at the turn of the century. But most of all, they owe their longevity to the remarkable resource that was available in those years, and that was the old-growth fir that grew on the Puget Sound.
Most of the stuff on the boat is original. I mean, below waterline, the keel, most of the planks, some of the planks on here are over 40 feet long.
And Bassey says the Polaris double-sawn 8x8 frame, all vertical grain old-growth fir, is in great shape.
Because once a wood boat is in the salt water, the salt actually pickles the wood, and so it lasts longer. The only problem you have in salt water is that you can get chiritos or bugs, and they'll decay and eat the wood. Well, the good thing about most of our schooners is that we're berthed in Seattle, in the lake, so we get in fresh water every year. So when you get in fresh water kills all these bugs, so we don't have as much a problem with that.
When the Norwegian halibut schooners are not fishing, the boats are in Lake Union. Bassey has seen the historical pictures of lumber yards stretching from Lake Union to Puget Sound.
I think it was 2 or 3 mills there. And, you know, when they wanted a plank for the boat, they'd go out to the yard and they'd look at it. Oh, this looks good. Not a knot in it. You know, 40 feet long, straight grain, you know, perfect fir. And they'd grab it and take it over and use it.
But nowadays, it's difficult to find the fir and the craftsmen who can work on the old schooners. Bassey says he spends a couple of months each winter on maintenance, and his bill is huge. Dave Seaman is president of the Kachemak Bay Wooden Boat Society. When the Polaris pulled into Homer last week, it was his first time on one of the century-old schooners. He found it easy to romanticize.
The longevity of these boats, the way they're built, the way they've been fished, the fact that a lot of them stayed in the same families, it's sort of a dynasty thing. If I was a young man again, I'd be looking for a job on one of these. That's all I can tell you.
When you look at this thing, it's basically a dinosaur, really, to be honest with you.
The FV Polaris and her sister schooner sport all the GPS and other high-tech instruments, but aren't as versatile on the fishing grounds as modern vessels. If it weren't for the lucrative halibut individual fishing quotas implemented in 1995 and eliminating the race for fish, Bassey says most of the old fleet probably wouldn't be fishing right now.
But as far as a platform for longlining, it's ideal. You know, we're economical. We burn probably, you know, a third or a quarter of the fuel that some of those big boats do. And, you know, she's a real good sea boat. She rolls a lot, but she's always going to come back.
Bassey remembers the names of sister ships that aren't around anymore, but he expects his nephew will take over the Polaris when he retires.
And I know that the ones in the Seattle fleet, they're well taken care of. I mean, they'll be around for a while. They aren't going to go anywhere.
Beginning with black cod in the spring through halibut in the fall, the century-old schooners fish in the Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea, and Aleutian Chain. With help from Marshall Lynn and Homer, I'm Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau.
Friday's withdrawal of a state decision to renew a Sutton area coal permit will only temporarily halt further progress on the development. Department of Natural Resources Coal Regulatory Program Manager Russell Kirkham says the permit held by Ranger Alaska is renewed every 5 years.
The permit held by Ranger Alaska basically was issued in 1995 and has been renewed on 5-year intervals ever since. This is the third renewal of the permit. So under state law, they're allowed to have the successive renewals.
Kirkham says the company has to apply for renewal 120 days before the expiration of the permit, but the company has the right to continue operations under the permit until the renewal is finalized. The Chicoloon Village Tribal Council and other groups have commented in opposition to the underground coal development at Jonesville near Sutton. Kirkham says one of those comments was omitted from the decision to renew Ranger Alaska's permit, causing DNR to withdraw the renewal approval.
There was an issue with the renewal decision. We pretty much missed the comment, and we decided to withdraw that decision to address that comment. And we plan to reissue that decision once we correct that defect.
Kirkham says DNR is now back to making a final decision on Ranger Alaska's renewal. He says the next step is to address the missing comment, reissue the decision to renew the permit, and then open up a hearing phase for those opposed to the decision to have their concerns heard. The federal government is looking for public input on Shell's plan to do exploratory drilling in the Beaufort Sea next summer. The company plans to drill 4 test wells about 20 miles off Alaska's coast. The Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management will spend the next 30 days evaluating the plan, and as part of that process, the agency is accepting public comments until July 15th. Shell also wants to drill exploratory wells in the Chukchi Sea in 2012, but that proposal isn't ready yet for public comment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Southeast Tribal representatives met in Juneau last week to discuss environmental issues and programs. The 4-day conference attracted about 40 people who talked about traditional knowledge, recycling, and working with government agencies. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Yakutat Elder Elaine Abraham has worked for years with the Alaska Native Science Commission. The group focuses on integrating Native knowledge in scientific research. She told conference attendees that studies of historic sealing camps provide one example of the role traditional knowledge can play in environmental studies. She says tribal members used oral history to help archaeologists. They located camps on old shorelines near her hometown that are now inland because of rising land.
From a memory culture, the men were were able to draw maps of areas they've never seen, because our people are now hunting what was under the water.
She says researchers found an old bag dated 140 years ago in one spot. In another research, they found numerous trade beads. Abraham, who has worked with the University of Alaska and Sheldon Jackson College, says such collaborations need to increase.
What I'd like to see is Southeast begin to do validation of their oral history, along with a partnering with the Western Signs, that we have a new kind of group that are now Western Signs, and they are more than willing to work with you.
Her granddaughter, Maka Montour, provided the conference with a perspective on the role young people can play. The recent high school graduate is active in Yakutat's chapter of Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. She says Native teenagers make up about 45% of the group's statewide membership. Their current campaign focuses on protecting a traditional food. It includes pledge cards and lobbying for legislation.
We decided on the campaign of salmon and the potential threats to salmon in the state of Alaska today, including Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay, and what we call frankenfish, genetically modified salmon.
The Southeast Environmental Conference was organized by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Conference organizers attracted representatives of tribal governments and staff from state and federal agencies. Central Council Environmental Coordinator Leilani Knight McQueen says she also invited Native Corporation representatives, though none came. Sea Alaska spokesman Todd Antioquia cited a scheduling conflict. Knight McQueen says the event was still a success.
I think there's a newfound love and encouragement for how we continue to pass on culture and tradition as it relates to the environment, and engaged with our youth in a healthy way. And what I saw happen in this conference was newfound commitments individually and tribally.
The conference also included information about water and air quality monitoring and contaminated site cleanup. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The state of Alaska is preparing for the expansion of broadband internet to much of rural Alaska by starting a new training program to get technicians ready to maintain personal computers and networks in the remote villages of Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The new training program is specifically geared towards students in rural Alaska, and it will be housed at the AvTech facility in Seward, which has been under the direction of Fred Esposito for the last 16 years.
We're working with the Alaska Distance Education Consortium as a part of a federal grant that they received to get out ahead of, or just in time with, the expansion of broadband into rural Alaska. We're trying to build the capacity of folks in rural Alaska to be able to utilize the internet and utilize computer technology for a variety of different areas that they might be interested in using that for. So this is a brand new offering for us.
The program is called the Village Internet Agent Program, and it's a partnership between AvTech, the University of Alaska, and 20 other organizations. The program is funded by a $4.5 million federal grant as part of the Broadband Technology Opportunities Program. Esposito anticipates graduates of the Village Internet Agent Program will go on to be employed by the internet providers spread out across rural Alaska.
We're hopeful that we'll be able to put the right kind of training in place to provide this basic, it's not really very basic, it's sort of a moderate technology training to provide someone in each community that can work with the internet provider, perhaps work with the school, the library, the health clinic, anyone who might need those kind of technical services.
Since the new program is grant-funded, those accepted will get free tuition, books, and supplies. However, students will be responsible for their housing, meals, and travel. Esposito says the state is working with many organizations in rural Alaska in an effort to offset some of the costs that could be incurred by students in the new program.
So that's why we're kind of trying to reach out to various Native corporations and nonprofit organizations that might be able to help with those costs as students might apply for the program.
The first four-month course as part of the new program begins August the 23rd and runs through December 15th. Classes will run about 6 hours a day, and there will be a second four-month offering of the program next year from January 17th through May 10th. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Small towns in Alaska have a tradition of going big to celebrate the 4th of July. KDLG's Melody Kay attended the festivities in Togiak and brought back this report.
At first listen to Conversations in Togiak, you'd think you were in another country. Yupik is spoken here much more than it is in many towns in Bristol Bay, and Czech is often heard at the town's only seafood processor, where a little under half the staff is from the Czech Republic or Slovakia. But Independence Day celebrations in the southwest Alaskan town of 812 had all the trappings of an all-American town. There was a parade.
We light on the fire truck everywhere. Up the hill,
down the hill, all around
and
home.
Even at the playground.
There were burgers.
I'm making burgers and hot dogs for everybody.
Face paint.
Putting on their face.
Competitions like musical chairs or musical buckets.
So find the bucket, sit on the bucket, sit on the bucket. Everybody find the bucket.
And pride.
We have more privilege
up here.
So, yeah.
Why?
Because here in my own village right there, we know everybody, so we're safe. That's how I feel on 4th of July. Everybody's safe.
For Katrina Yankova and Alzbeta Popilkova, Togiak is actually better than they imagined America to be. It's Alaska, explain the two Czechs who work at the town's only fish processor, Togiak Seafoods.
No. It's Togiak is a little bit, it's like the end of the world, the end of America for us.
It is magic because we're interested in nature and Alaska is perfect.
Yeah.
So we want to try it.
And to cap off the event, there were hours of fireworks, albeit sporadic, shot off from the beach at midnight during low tide. Reporting in Togiak, this is Melody Kay.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Mark Mason in Dillingham, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Marsha Lynn in Homer, and Melody Kay in Togiak. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com,
and by
AT&T, Rethink Possible, details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.